100 hours. We're at the offices of Dan Fulgham, and we're going to be interviewing him about the Roswell incident.
We spoke about the investigation that was conducted last year. The Secretary of the Air Force was asked by the General County Office to look into some information about what's been known as the Roswell incident. And we looked into that, and we wrote a quite lengthy report last summer, and I provided you a copy. And we've come to, after that investigation, we've come to determine that perhaps some of the people were relating not something that happened in 1947, but something that happened to you personally in 1959. And we'd just like to ask what you remember about it.
All right, this is Dan Fulgham, and I will respond to your questions.
Okay. If you could just start off with when you entered the Air Force and what some of the positions you held throughout your career.
I came into the Air Force through the Aviation Cadet Program, graduating from flying training at Bryan Air Force Base in March the 22nd of 1952. From there I went to gunnery training at Luke Air Force Base in F-80s and F-84s and proceeded directly on to the Korean conflict. As I recall, reporting in somewhere around August of 1952 to FEMCOM Area B outside of Tokyo for reassignment to the 474th Fighter Wing and F-84s at Kunsan, Korea. Flew 100 combat missions out of Kunsan and Taegu. The squadron that I was in was transferred sometime in the spring of 1953. And as I recall, I finished my combat tour in approximately May of 1953 and then returned to the U.S. and was assigned to Webb Air Force Base in Big Spring, Texas as a flight instructor in T-33 and T-28 aircraft. That tour lasted about 1955, and when I transferred to Randolph Air Force Base into the headquarters of the Combat Crew Training Command at that time. There was Flying Training Air Force, and I was in the crew training headquarters. I was the command coordinator for aviation physiology, since I had gone through aviation physiological training while at Webb. Command coordinator for what then became the Air Training Command. That sort of made me visible and eligible for an assignment to Aeromedical Laboratories at Wright-Patterson. I think I reported in there in late 1957 to their Aeromed Lab and was placed in charge of all of the high-altitude chambers at Wright-Patterson. It was during that period of time I became involved in the space program. The Air Force had a man in space program. There was more, all of the human activities of it were being run out of Wright-Patterson, out of the Aeromed Lab. And then when Sputnik went up and President Eisenhower created NASA, the old NACA, and took all of that program work, transferred it to NASA, and it became Mercury, became Project Mercury. And I worked then in the Mercury program, but still on the Air Force side. From Wright-Patt, it was off to Purdue for a master's degree in human factors engineering in 1959. Graduated there in 1960 and reported to the Flight Test Center as a bioastronautics project officer at Edwards Air Force Base. It was in the summer of 1960. At Wright-Patterson, though, that I became involved in the balloon training program since I was an active instructor pilot in T-33s over at the Flight Test Group. And then Joe Kittinger had this program had responsibility for several programs, as I recall, that involved piloted balloons, helium balloons. And of course, it was more than one person could handle, so Bill Kaufman and I were, had volunteered for and been selected to train as balloon pilots. It was during that period that we participated in the takeoff and landing and flying time out of Holloman. In the recall, on both of the training flights that we participated in before the accident occurred, all three of us flew on every flight. Those two.
Okay.
To get diverted on that, to go back to the flight test center at Edwards. Mentioned there in the bioastronautics group and my background in parachuting, the commander asked me to take on the additional duty of supervising the X-15 pararescue team, which I did, and that led me into more altitude parachuting in support of the X-20 and the Gemini program of Central California. That all occurred in the mid-60s. In 1966, I was selected for an assignment to Vietnam. I went through F-4 training at Georgia Air Force Base, reporting to the Peter Wing under Colonel Robin Olds in the fall of 1966, as I recall, it was about in October. Flying combat almost immediately in the attack fighter wing as a member of the Triple Nickel Squadron. 133 missions, 100 over the north, some 16 into Bay Area, Route Pack 6, and finished up there, and I think, as I recall, in June of 1967. To the U.S. in 67, and was assigned to Gunner Air Force Base in the Corona Harvest Project, which was to write the history of the Vietnam War. Well, there I had an interesting assignment in 1968 to join up with the history office, Colonel Burton Shaw out of PACAF in Hawaii, and write the Pueblo incident from the Air Force point of view, which was quite an interesting project. Took about weeks to do that. From there, I went back to Purdue for a PhD, reporting to Purdue in 1968, and graduated from Purdue. Was assigned as chief of the flying training simulation group under the Human Resources Laboratory at Williams Air Force Base. From 1985, at which time I reported to Brooks Air Force Base as Vice Commander of the Human Resources Laboratory, and then Commander of the Human Resources Laboratory, the position from which I retired in August of 1978. Commander of the Human Resources Laboratory, rank was 06. Since retirement from the Air Force in 1978, I've worked in the civilian research business. Still primarily in life sciences and human factors research. My present position is director of biosciences and bioengineering for Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. 8 years in that position.
Okay. Well, now we'll go back to the situation that we think may have been become a part of this mythology surrounding this Roswell incident. If you could just briefly describe how you became involved in this the high-altitude ballooning with Captain, now Colonel Joe Kittinger.
I don't remember the exact mode we took in order to get involved in the program, other than we just, it was something different and we wanted to take a shot at it, but essentially it was that Joe needed some support in several projects, one of which was to fly a scientist to 80,000 feet in a balloon suspended gondola to take pictures of Mars from a gyro-stabilized platform.
A stargazer.
And there were to be several flights in that project, and we wanted backup balloon pilots for that. Another one was High Dive, as I recall it was called High Dive,
mm-hmm.
in which high-altitude jumps were to be made from an open gondola, and since I was parachute qualified, I did be one of the jumpers. And Bill Kaufman was not jump qualified, but he had volunteered to at least be one of the balloon pilots.
I believe he did have previous experience.
Yeah. There was some reason that he was involved too, but it was mandated by the it wasn't the FAA, that was probably the CAA, that we had to have a license in order to fly in controlled airspace, if you will. Nobody knew anything about balloon licensing.
This was before the hot air balloon had even been invented.
It was
widely used.
Right. This was all helium, and the Air Force was the only people that could afford helium in those days, and so we did the majority of all the helium ballooning. Air Force and Navy. We went to the CAA or whatever it was called in those days and asked them to issue balloon licenses, and the best they could come up with was a student pilot license. And I think they just arbitrarily said you got to have X number of landings and so many hours to be given your license. Being the most qualified to instruct, since he had quite a bit of balloon time, we put together a program to go to Holloman and accrue the number of hours of flying time and the number of landings necessary to qualify Bill Kaufman and I as student balloon pilots, if you will, so we could participate in the program. First flight out was an all-night flight. In both cases, they were all-night flights. And in the first flight, we terminated just north of El Paso and recovered by helicopter and taken back to the Holloman. And on the second flight was one in which we took off with the intention of landing at Roswell at daylight, and that's exactly what the flight plan turned out to be. We landed just right in the outskirts of the city of Roswell just after sunrise.
Which was it, north of town or south? I don't remember.
I think it was north of town.
Okay.
Just
so we found
it that picture.
In the range record, it seemed to be that it was north of town. So could you just describe on that second flight there is when you had the little mishap? And how that came about.
Okay. We've been flying all night, and as daylight approached and it became light enough to see the ground, we valved off some gas and went down and started shooting practice landings, touch-and-go landings, and Kittinger instructed us how to stand on the outside of the gondola, and when it touched down on the ground, just jump off, and that would give enough rebound to the balloon that it would go bouncing back into the air, and that way we didn't have to dump ballast right away, and you just had to scramble to hold on to the side of the gondola from the outside. And Joe shot some landings to demonstrate, and I shot a series of landings, and then Bill Kaufman took over the controls. controls being a cup of lead shot in one hand and the lanyard to valve gas in the other, and you could adjust your rate of descent and then time your touchdown so it had just enough so that you'd hit the ground with enough force to make contact but rebound. It'd take enough, there'd be enough balloon inertia to come on down a little bit and then it would rebound and take you back up into
give you
the air,
touch and go.
100 feet or so, something like that. It was now approaching sunrise, and of course what was going to happen as soon as the sun cracked the horizon, the wind would come up. And we knew that anything above 10 knots wind would probably wind up having to fly all day and all night again before we could land, because it was just too dangerous to land in wind. Of course, out in that desert, the wind came up and stayed up 25, 30 knots all the time during the daytime. So we were approaching the town, we could see we were approaching the town, and Joe said, there's a clearing over there just this side of the highway where the school is located. And Joe said, we better get down into that clearing because the wind was coming up, our lateral speed was increasing all the time. So we better try and make that field, or we may run out of any place to land. We'll be downtown before we know it. And so we valve gas at a pretty good rate to clear the trees that surrounded that field, and then to try and get a vertical descent rate high enough that would get us into this this open area. And how big it was, 4, 5, 6 acres maybe. Mm. In size, maybe a few more than that, but not much more. Just prior to that, when we decided we better make it a final landing, I said, why don't we clean up this cockpit a little bit, the gondola, because our helmets were lying in the bottom of the gondola, some other crap down there. So I picked up my helmet and put it on. Everybody put their helmets on because we hadn't been flying.
Was Kittinger wearing that Canadian hunter's hat?
I don't recall what Joe had on. Bill had the same kind of hat I had on. It's one of those bicycle hats or helmets that was
that you gave me.
Yeah, Bill and I wore those. Those were developed for SAC air crews. You know, they had to go up and stay up 24 and, hours at a time, and a regular P1 helmet in those days was just so damn heavy and hot.
Well, I think that's what Kaufman has on. He has the standard issue helmet.
Yeah, he might.
And then you have the experimental.
Yeah, mine was that SAC helmet that I had gotten there. It was cool.
The long missions they were flying.
Put my helmet on, and it looked like we were going to be all right coming into the field, even though our lateral speed was up a little bit. And the way we affected a final landing was to we had an electric squid, and we could uncover the toggle switch, and when we activated the toggle switch, it blew an electric or sent electric charge to an explosive bolt that held the balloon to the top of the parachute. And the technique was to let the gondola hit the ground to kill some lateral speed and hit the switch before the balloon could rebound.
To cut loose the balloon.
Yeah, to cut loose the balloon. So before it rebounded and carried the gondola back up again. And what happened was Bill hit the switch just a fraction too soon, and we still had too much lateral speed, but when the balloon cut loose, the lateral speed was such that the gondola tin canned on the ground, which meant just like you throw an open-ended tin can down on the ground and it just tumbled end over end. I don't remember how many times it did that, maybe once or twice. Came to rest upside down. And my position in the gondola was on the bottom of the stack with my head wedged in between the lip of the gondola and the ground. And Bill Kaufman and Joe Kittinger were on top of me so that I couldn't move because they were, their combined weight was just pinned me to the ground. And of course they got that sorted out right quick and got moved off the top of me, and then we jacked up the gondola and turned it over on its side. And we crawled out. I forgot, the gondola weighed 600 pounds or something like that.
You know, imagine for three guys.
So we were trying to assess, you know, our state, or the damage to the gondola. Nobody appeared to be hurt. There was no pain or strain or anything, but Joe had a cut under his eye, and it looked like it was about a half inch in length, but it was just bleeding like a stuck pig, and it didn't look like a very deep cut either, or, you know, any facial cut bleeds quite a bit anyway. But he appeared to be more wounded than he really was. It was not a serious cut at all. I was moving around the gondola and doing the same thing the other two were, just picking up equipment and seeing what the status was and everything. And I think the helicopter came in about that time also.
Yeah. Sure, H-21.
Yeah, but that's from the first flight.
Okay.
That is not
right.
The Roswell flight. That's the one where we recovered out near El Paso, just short of Guadalupe Peak.
Right.
But that's the same helicopter from Holloman. One tracked us all night. That's the same one that came over and picked me up and flew me back to Holloman from the hospital. During this moving around, I reached up to do something about my face, either brush something off, didn't no pain, no strain or anything. And I felt my forehead out in front of the helmet. I didn't realize it at first. There was something there, like padding or whatever. And so then when I pushed it with my fingers, I realized it was my forehead. And I thought, well, for Christ's sake, you know, I apparently damaged something because my forehead shouldn't be sticking out in front of the helmet.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, uh-oh, I know I'm smart enough to know if I did something that I'm just not feeling yet because there's no pain there or anything, I may be injured to a point that I could go into shock or something if I keep moving around. So I sat down immediately and took my helmet off. Well, when I took my helmet off, my head started swelling, not just my forehead, but all of my head started swelling. And I found out subsequently from the doctor that what had happened was I had crushed a lot of the blood vessels in the nerves when that gondola had landed on top of my head and pinned me between it and the ground. It did it on almost a face up attitude, so I got front and rear crushing motion, and it did crush those blood vessels and nerves, and that's why I wasn't feeling anything, because the nerves were dead, and the blood, the free blood that was pouring out of these capillaries and vessels was swelling my head. It had to go somewhere, and there was enough free skin there that's loose enough, it started swelling up.
You felt it right away?
Yeah.
As well.
Oh yeah, sure. When I still had my helmet on, I could feel my forehead puffed out in front of my helmet. Now, that's not normal.
Yeah, so I would say that. So, no.
So I still felt no pain, no problem, but it was getting to the point now that my face was beginning to swell a little bit from all this liquid and everything, and finally my eyes swelled shut. Eyelids swelled shut too.
Is this why you're still out there?
No, I think this was a progressive thing by the time I got to the hospital.
Okay.
The swelling was beginning pretty bad. It ultimately got to the point where the only way I could see was to take my thumb and index finger and spread my eyelids. There's nothing wrong with my vision or anything other than my eyes were swollen shut. I could spread my eyelids and see, And then as soon as I let go, my eyelid snapped shut again.
So now you're injured, and you decided to lay down and to figure out what's going on.
Well, I just didn't want to be up moving around in case my system was subject to going into shock.
Okay.
But I knew enough about physiology, and after all, we were in the life sciences business and knew that pretty well. I don't recall the exact sequence of events. There was nothing spectacular or nothing notable or noteworthy about it. One that no matter how, I couldn't see myself, so I didn't know how bad I looked.
Mm-hmm.
But I could tell by feeling that my head was considerably enlarged. And it's the sort of thing where somebody said, well, you don't look too hot. But I assured him I didn't feel bad. So when we arrived at the hospital...
So how did they get you to the hospital?
I thought we flew over in the helicopter. I think I remember getting out of the helicopter on the flight ramp at Roswell.
Mm-hmm. So it was probably a 5-minute flight, very short flight.
Very, very short, very short.
Okay.
As I recall, when we got there, there was not a doctor immediately available, and I think they had to call the doctor to come to the hospital.
Do you remember anything about your arrival?
If we landed on the flight ramp, we probably wound up riding an ambulance to the hospital, would be my guess.
You think you were walking, or did you lay down? Or?
No, I was walking. There wasn't anything wrong with me. I felt fine. In fact, I remember very clearly, even before either one of us were treated, Joe Kittredge and I sitting out on the front steps of the hospital smoking cigarettes.
Okay.
We went outside to smoke, and Joe's eye was still bleeding. Not profusely, but he was still bloody from that little cut on his face.
So you sat out there. Were there civilians in the area?
I don't remember seeing anybody. It was early in the morning.
And you don't believe?
What we were waiting for was the doctor to get there. And I recall at that time, there was this controversy going on with security in the hospital about who the hell were we anyway? You know, we weren't supposed to be there, and nobody knew anything about the Air Force officers flying balloons, and we could have been intruders. You know, one of Kurt LeMay's famous penetrate the security teams. And I remember Joe trying to get a hold of Colonel Stapp to establish our identities and who we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that occurred sometime during the morning. Well, in the meantime, the doctor showed up and he examined, you know, he wanted to do an examination. You know, we better wrap that head in something. So he used an ACE bandage and wrapped my head to keep it from continuing to swell.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe I remember him discussing with me at that time as whether or not we ought to aspirate some of that fluid.
Mm-hmm.
Decision, yes or no. And I do know the decision was made, well, the helicopter was there, they wanted to fly us back to Holloman. So, me back to the fly line and in the helicopter. And at that time, as I recall earlier, you know, I couldn't remember whether I spent the night at Roswell or went back to Holloman, but the record seems to indicate
right. That
I flew back to Holloman.
Yeah, you're
on that ACE-21.
From your medical record, it shows you spending the night at Holloman Hospital.
And there was some kind of party that night, and I put on my uniform and went to the party.
Uh-huh.
And my head was wrapped in ACE bandage, and my eyes were swollen shut. I had to be led around, and I just took the position of hell. I felt fine, I didn't have a headache, didn't feel bad. So I just stood around in the crowd with my hand out, and there's somebody always kept feeding me drinks and talking about how bad I looked, because my eyes were now totally swollen shut and black underneath and really didn't look swift at all.
Were people shocked to see you? I mean, oh, did you look like yourself?
No, you couldn't recognize me. You couldn't recognize me at all.
And your head was much bigger than it normally was?
Yeah, much bigger. And this was that night. Uh-huh. The next day, or the day after, I guess it was the next day on Sunday, the flight surgeon at Holloman says, you know, said, we've got to do something about that swollen head, because what'll happen is scar tissue will form under there and you'll be permanently disfigured. He said, you probably already are going to be permanently disfigured to some degree. But some of that swelling may never go away because of scar tissue and everything. And he said, what we need to do is aspirate some of that fluid out there and compress it down and see what we can do.
According to your record, Dr. Leslie Eason, and I spoke with him, he aspirated 20 cc's of blood.
Yeah, so he came at me with one of those guiding huge needles. I forgot what the size it was now, but...
Yeah, according to your record, he did. He aspirated the blood the day of the accident back in Holland.
8 millimeter or something like that.
20 cc's of bloody fluid.
Let's see what size needle he used. It was about an 8 millimeter, as I recall. I just remember it was a big damn needle. It didn't particularly hurt because my head was still numb. The scalp and everything was numb, but he did take a lot of fluid out and rewrapped it again in ace bandage to keep it down as tight as he could.
Mm-hmm. So in this picture,
my head is considerably reduced from what it was.
So this is back at Wright-Patterson.
Yeah,
some days
back
later.
At Wright-Patterson. That's on Monday or Tuesday.
Right, we had you returning on Sunday, according to the record.
Yeah, it had been on Monday or, well, that could have been Sunday afternoon.
Right, that.
Yeah, back at Wright-Patterson. I don't remember. I remember being in the airplane on the way back.
Okay.
But there was nothing notable about the flight that fixed it in my mind or anything like that. We're just going back to Wright-Patterson.
Okay. Before we move on a little bit, I just want to ask you what you remember about being at the hospital there. You said you remembered arriving, smoking at Walker Air Force Base.
Roswell.
And remember having a cigarette on the front steps, and you don't remember civilians being in the area?
I don't. I really don't.
Okay. Do you remember any nurses being in the area or assisting in the treatment?
I don't. A doctor being there to, you know, talking to me about does it hurt, and that's sort of, you know, the typical medical exam.
Was there, how many doctors? Was it one, many doctors or one doctor?
Just one that I remember. I don't remember seeing. Could have been other doctors in the hospital, but only.
Who was he? Was he, to your knowledge?
I don't even remember if he was one of the flight surgeons or not. He was one of the Air Force doctors assigned to the hospital.
Okay.
Keep in mind, by this time now, my eyes are swollen shut.
Okay.
So I'm not seeing much of anything. And if somebody asked me a question or something, and I thought I needed to see them to respond to it, I'd pry my eyelids apart and look at them. But other than that, you know, when I talked to people, I just responded to verbal.
Mm-hmm. So did they keep you like in an examining room, or did you sit in a waiting room?
No, I didn't sit in the waiting room, but I was perfectly ambulatory and could get up and move around. Whether or not I might go into shock also, so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember sitting either on an examining table or a bed. My head was swollen. This time, my forehead, before they aspirated all the fluid, my forehead was actually drooping down over my eyebrows. It was that much fluid in there. It was that big. It was just drooping down in front.
And this was, you think this was when you were a walker?
Yeah.
So the swelling was almost immediate, huh?
Yeah, there's a lot of loose fluid. See, the damaged blood vessels were leaking fluid into the into the scalp, lots of it. Okay. And over time, let's see if this shows it. Now, this is on Monday. That's loose blood, see, that's coming down out of here, all around my nose and everything there. My entire face turned yellow all the way down to where the interstitial tissues are attached to the collarbone and in the sternum. So I was yellow like a Chinese or an Oriental. All over my face and down to that V, and from there on I was white. Mm-hmm. But as far as that free blood could drain, I turned yellow and black, just like a bruise. And that's the beginning of it there, but that progressed and got worse and worse as time went by.
Okay. While you were at the hospital, you said that Captain Kittinger was trying to contact Dr. Stapp, John Paul Stapp, back home.
Not at Holloman. He was at Wright-Patterson.
He was at Wright-Patterson.
Yeah.
But by this time, was he Aeromed Laboratory Commander?
Yes. He's Aeromed Commander.
Okay. So Kittinger was reporting into him.
And I'm not so sure that we were as much concerned about reporting into him as we were establishing our identity.
For
the security
people. Did they?
That was my impression of what the urgency of getting hold of Stapp was. There would be two things. One, Stapp hearing that there had been a problem and him not knowing about it, so we wanted to report to him, yeah, we had an accident, but everybody's all right. Mm-hmm. And no great damage done, no damage to the gondola or anything like that. Just got cut up a little bit, but everything's fine. And the other was, I think the more urgent part of it was the identity problem. The sack was damn serious about security.
So is this commonplace in the Air Force, or as far as getting involved with SAC?
Oh yes, absolutely. Security of the nuclear strike force was paramount. SAC ran the Air Force in those days.
I see, but you weren't SAC, but did you ever have a run-in with these guys, or?
Run-ins with them? Yeah. Security people and SAC bases? Yeah, lots of times. And single-engine airplanes around, you're always going to wind up in a position where I don't care if it is a SAC base, I got to land. You know, I got to get fuel or something, or the weather's bad and you can't go any further and you got to land. It was always, if you landed without prior permission, you were going to get interrogated by the security people. And the Curtis LeMay liked better than to send out people that just suddenly showed up and landed on the base. And everybody said, well, it's an Air Force airplane, so it's okay. And then out would come his IG and just really rip everybody. Probably more wing commanders lost their jobs over that kind of thing than anything else that happened.
So, Captain Joe Kittinger, how would you describe him physically?
Joe was about average height. He was always a little bit on the heavy side, not necessarily not fat, but he was stocky built, red hair, freckle face.
What kind of red hair was it? A little red, or?
It was red. It was carrot red.
He's a pretty formidable figure. If you look at him.
Well, we didn't think so. We were just all captains together. Okay.
Did you? I know you were getting treated, but at that time, did you hear or discussion or overhear any altercations that Colonel Kittinger may have gotten into that day?
Never heard anything. Mostly involved in the physical exam and stuff like that. Joe and Bill were off doing whatever they were doing.
Captain Kittinger at that time, would he have ever had an NCO that assisted him on this particular morning who would have been a black man that you can remember?
I don't remember that. I really don't remember a black NCO. I know that there were a lot of people that were involved in helping in the operation, that sort of thing, but I can't remember them specifically. So my contacts with that crew, the actual flight crew and everything, was at night. Because that's when we went down and inflated the balloon and made the takeoff, was after dark. Didn't belong to my operation back at Wright Pat. And all the two flights that we made were the only two times I was ever at Holloman. So I didn't know any of those people at all. And Joe flew out there all the time, so he knew them quite well.
Okay. So getting back to Holloman when you're getting ready to leave, who else was on the 131? Was it a regularly scheduled flight, or?
It took us back to Wright Pat. I don't recall. They had, in those days, kind of a shuttle service that went around out of AFSC headquarters at, not headquarters, but out of Wright-Patterson.
Sure.
And this could have been one of the shuttles, or they sent an airplane out special, or I just don't know.
Okay.
If they returned us on Monday in this accident, 30. Or would they send somebody out special if it was one of the shuttles that was just moving around at the time?
Okay.
And it could have been anybody. I could have known. And we got back to Wright Pat. Of course, that R&D community there, even though a huge base and everything, is a pretty small knit community anyway. But I had talked to my wife just from the minute I got back to Holloman, just to let her know that I had been in an accident, but I wasn't hurt, because I didn't know what kind of publicity had gotten out in the newspapers or anything. And told her I was just fine, a little banged up, but nothing to be worried about. But I looked awful, and when I got off the airplane at Wright Pat, and of course the base operations, they called her and told her what time I was going to be there on the airplane and everything. So she was there to meet me, and when I came down the stairs of the airplane, and she was there on the ramp close to the steps, and she saw me and realized that was me, she just burst into tears because I looked so awful. And I looked like I ought to be more dead than alive. And that was sort of the reaction I got from everybody. In fact, when I went back to the lab the next day on the job, I walked in and stood at the desk in front of my secretary. My secretary was talking to her and mentioned this or that, and all of a sudden there was this long pause, and she looked at me and she said, "Captain Folger, is that you?" And she burst into tears because she had been talking to me, not realizing who I was. That's how different I really looked. And with my eyes swollen shut and black marks all over my face from that blood draining down, I just looked like somebody that evoked immediate compassionate sympathy. You know? Mm-hmm. I just, people said, "God almighty, that guy is really a mess." And of course, I didn't feel bad at all, except that anytime I lowered my head and my torso enough to raise my blood pressure, I didn't do that very much or very long, because it was very painful, because as these nerves began to come back to life, I had some pretty bad headaches. In fact, at night I couldn't sleep lying down. I had to sleep sitting up because of the pain, you know, just throbbing pain. And that went on for a couple of weeks. But other than that, I was fine. I was back to full duty.
Back to flying status?
And well, I'd go back to flying for a while until my head settled down enough to wear a helmet. And my eyes opened up and say, "Where are you starting to do?"
The end of your balloon flying career?
Yeah, we didn't, I think that incident didn't have anything to do with it, but the budget crunch got us, and we wound up with just enough money for Joe to make a couple of flights. And so since he was a senior officer of the three of us and had the most experience, he elected to go ahead and do both of those high dive jumps.
Actually, three of them.
Both three. I remember two of them, but And then I don't think the Stargazer ever got off the ground.
Yeah, it did.
Did it?
It did.
Who flew that? I don't know.
Kittinger with Dr. White from the China Lake Naval Research Laboratory.
Okay. And I just didn't, because it wasn't too long after that that I think I was going to Purdue then.
Right. Final questions for you. While you were there at the AeroMed Lab, during the mid-50s, did you ever hear people discussing or talking, late 50s, discussing any of this UFO business?
No, I don't remember any of it ever being discussed. I know that all through the 50s, though, there were occasionally stories or articles in the newspaper about pilots seeing UFOs or UFOs being reported, but that's been going on for forever. But I remember a couple of commercial airline pilots, who the hell was it, TWA or somebody like that, reported seeing a long lighted cigar shape in the sky flying along with them, and that sort of, but they were always things like that.